Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is a special election edition of Your Call. San Francisco Supervisor Scott Wiener and Jane Kim are in a tight race to fill California State Senator Mark Leno's seat representing San Francisco and San Mateo counties. Whoever wins in November could hold this important seat in Sacramento for as many as 12 years and represent 1 million people. On October 20th, Supervisor Jane Kim will join us to talk about her platform and why she's running. Today, we are joined by Supervisor Scott Wiener. Supervisor Wiener represents the Castro, Glen Park, Noe Valley, Diamond Heights, Twin Peaks, DuBose Triangle, Buena Vista, Corona Heights, and parts of the Mission. Supervisor Wiener serves on the board's Land Use and Economic Development Committee and Budget and Finance Committee. Before being elected to the board in 2010, he served as deputy city attorney in the San Francisco City Attorney's Office. He also served as chair of the San Francisco Democratic Party, and he's currently an elected member of the Democratic County Central Committee. Supervisor Wiener has been endorsed by State Senator Mark Leno, the Democratic Party, Senator Dianne Feinstein, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, Attorney General Kamala Harris, San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee, Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf, and many others. And this is turning out to be a very expensive race. Supervisor Wiener has raised over $2 million. So what questions do you have for Supervisor Scott Wiener about why he's running and his platform? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet at yourcallradio. And Supervisor Scott Wiener joins me in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So the state legislature is very, very important, probably even more important now that the Republicans have hijacked the legislative process at the federal level. Mm-hmm. And this is a really important seat that you're running for. You might represent 1 million people, and you could be there for 12 years. Why are you running for this seat?
First of all, thank you for having me. And I agree, the state legislature is incredibly important. It does not get nearly the exposure it should get in terms of the press coverage, and we frankly get more coverage in City Hall than the legislature gets. But when you look at the decisions that the legislature, including the state Senate, make around are we going to have equitable and sufficient funding for public education so that all children can learn, who's going to get access to health care, including the 1 in 3 Californians who rely on Medi-Cal? Are we going to drag our 19th century water system into the 21st century? Are we going to have enough housing in California and recognize that the state has a role to play in this statewide affordability crisis? These issues are so critical, and it matters who represents us in the state Senate. There are only 40 state senators for the 6th largest economy in the world. One state senator has a huge, huge impact. So the election does matter. And in San Francisco, it's really the luxury and the obligation to represent a strong progressive voice, which is what I have always done in City Hall and what I will do in the state legislature. I'm running for the state Senate really for the same reason I ran for the Board of Supervisors, that I deeply believe that when government is done right, it can improve people's lives. And so whether it's the legislation that I authored to expand paid parental leave and make San Francisco on the cutting edge of paid parental leave in our country.
And that passed.
That passed, making us the first. Or the legislation I authored to tie public transportation funding to population growth to make sure our transit systems are keeping up with our growth, or whether it's when I push back against insurance companies that were jacking up copays on life-saving HIV and other drugs and making them impossible for people to afford, or the legislation I authored to create new rent-controlled in-law units in San Francisco, something that had previously been thought impossible. Over and over again, I have fought for progressive change. And we have an obligation to do that. And I want to take that work to Sacramento.
The budget is a very important document that not enough people pay attention to. Luckily, there is more money being spent on education, but still, so many schools are trapped. I've got friends who are teachers who have to buy their own school supplies, their own food. They're seeing so much poverty in their schools. And then when you look at prisons, there's so much money being spent on prisons. The LA Times had an op-ed recently that found per capita prison costs in California over the last 4 years have jumped from $49,000 to $64,000 annually. That would be enough to send someone to a private school in California. I mean, it's really shameful when you think about the money that's spent on education versus prisons in a state like California. How are you going to tackle that issue?
Yeah, well, we need to continue on our path of reducing prison populations. We, in California, like much of the country, were pursuing mass incarceration for many, many years and growing our prison systems, putting people in for long terms, for drug offenses, for offenses where maybe there was no incarceration required, or if you're going to incarcerate, you should do it for a much shorter period of time to try to rehabilitate people and not ruin their lives. And so, you know, I did support realignment. I supported Prop 47. And we have to be smart about how we're doing criminal justice in this state and incarceration. That doesn't mean no one should be incarcerated. There are people who need to be off the streets. But we have to be smart about it and not have excessive incarceration. In terms of our schools, you know, I'm incredibly passionate about public education. It's personal for me. I'm a product of K through 12 public education. I'm the only candidate in this race who is. My mother was a public school teacher. My aunt was a public school teacher. I had great uncles who were public school teachers. My nephews are in public school in New York City. This matters. It is one of the great equalizers in our society and something that allows kids from middle class, working class, low income backgrounds to succeed. And we are failing our children in California. California used to be one of the best funded public education systems in the country, right near the top. We're now languishing in the 40s in per pupil spending. It's about $11,000 or so dollars per student. But that is not the same throughout California. There in San Mateo County, for example, in the northern parts of the county, in Daly City, it's less than that. In some of the southern parts that are wealthier, it's more, because we have a system of education funding in California that is not equitable. And so our lower-income kids are suffering as a result. We also know that we have a teacher shortage in San Francisco, but elsewhere, and we do not pay our teachers enough. We talk a lot about teacher housing, and I'm all for creative solutions for housing, but the better approach, or maybe the best approach, is just to pay our teachers enough that they can actually afford housing, the housing that they choose and that they can raise their families. We are hemorrhaging teachers. Teachers cannot afford to live here. They're engaging in long commutes, or they're just leaving entirely. And that is profoundly counterproductive in terms of educating our children.
We have a couple of propositions on the ballot. There are 17. A few would affect spending and education. Prop 55 would extend the 2012 voter-approved tax increases on high-income earners. It's expected to bring in $4 billion to $9 billion a year. From 2019 to 2030, most of that money would go to K through 12 education. Where do you stand on Prop 55?
I strongly support it. It's a partial renewal of Prop 30 that the governor sponsored and the voters passed in 2012, which really helped at least stabilize public education in California. You may recall we were for a long time seeing massive teacher layoffs, very volatile budgets in our public schools. Prop 30, which will be extended with Prop 55, helped to stop the bleeding. And so it's critically important that Prop 55 pass.
And then we also have a Prop 57, which would increase the number of nonviolent inmates eligible for parole consideration and enable inmates to earn credits for good behavior. Where do you stand on Prop 57?
I support it. The governor crafted Prop 57 and put it on the ballot. Again, it is part of an effort to try to have a more rational approach to incarceration in California.
I also want to ask you about our homeless crisis. We're getting a lot of emails about that. This is a major issue. I've lived in San Francisco since 95, grew up in California, and have never seen it so bad. The homeless population, according to official numbers, is 7,000. And earlier this year, you received a lot of criticism by advocating for the removal of homeless tents in the city. They're now popping up in other neighborhoods. You wrote in to the heads of six city agencies saying these tents are a public safety and a public health problem for the people living in them and for our neighborhoods. Jenny Friedenbach, who's the ED of the Coalition on Homelessness, says he's talking about ripping these tents from people who have no other choice but to sleep on the street. This is a very heated debate in this city. What is your solution to this crisis? The last I read from various homeless advocates is the waiting list for shelters is just massive. People cannot find a place to sleep in the city of San Francisco, and not even in this city, although, you know, in many cities across the state.
Sure. So if you talk to any of our the people in our city government, for example, who are responsible for the shelter system, which, by the way, we're trying to revolutionize by shifting to what we call navigation centers, which are much, much better versions of shelters where entire encampments can come in off the street. People aren't divided from their partners or their friends. They can bring their dogs in with them. Fewer strict rules that sometimes dissuade people from wanting to come in. And so we're trying to modernize that system. And clearly we are working to increase our navigation center stock from one navigation center to 5 or 6. And I actually co-authored the sales tax that is on the ballot this year that, in addition to generating $100 million a year for transportation needs, will generate $50 million a year, $1 billion over 20 years, for permanent housing for homeless people and for increasing the number of navigation centers. So I have put my money where my mouth is over and over again in terms of funding services and housing for homeless people. Every year in the budget, I fight for funding for more housing and other services for homeless and at-risk youth. And I've done it again here fighting for this ballot measure. You're always going to have critics. Allowing people to live in tents, in squalor, on our public sidewalks is not progressive. And I'll tell you, someone came up to me when I was campaigning, it was a couple months ago, a woman. She said, "You know what? I didn't vote for you for supervisor. I voted for your opponent. I voted for John Avalos for mayor. I am a lefty, lefty, lefty." And she said, "I do not understand why my progressive comrades in arms have taken up the banner for letting people live and deteriorate and die in tents and sidewalks. I have made it my business to know what is happening on these tents. I've gone and delivered lunches to people in these tents. I've gone out at 4:30 in the morning with DPW when they do cleaning. I wanted to see it myself. I have seen inside these tents. Some of them are, you know, people keep them clean and tidy. Many of them, it is absolute squalor. Women are getting raped in these tents. And for us to allow a proliferation of tents, and if you're not doing anything about it, we have seen it proliferate. That is not healthy. It is not safe. And it is not humane. It's not progressive. We need to work very hard to get people out of the tents, into shelter, into housing. When the Division Street encampment was cleared, and my opponent, Jane Kim, not only supports legalizing putting a tent on a sidewalk, but vocally opposed clearing the Division Street encampment, which had just gotten completely out of control. The city was able to get a significant number of the people in those tents into shelter. Some people didn't want to go in the shelter,
right,
but a lot of them did get in the shelter. So this whole notion that there's never anywhere for anyone to go, and until we solve homelessness, an issue that has vexed us for 30, 35 years in a significant way in the city, until we solve that long-term problem, anyone can pitch a tent on any sidewalk, anywhere in front of anyone's house. I don't agree with that, and I don't think it's progressive to argue that people should be living in tents.
Part of the main problem, obviously, is the major lack of affordable housing. I mean, people who are making what we would call a decent salary these days can't afford housing. Part of the problem is that HUD at the national level has been completely gutted over the decades. So if you become state senator in California, what are you going to do to truly tackle this issue of affordable housing? And is this going to be near the top of your list?
It will be right up there. In addition to trying to rebuild our mental health safety net in California, which is another aspect of the problem, the state has been AWOL on a lot of mental health issues, and you should not have to commit a crime and go to jail in order to get mental health services. It should be available in the community. Absolutely. As I mentioned at the beginning, the state must play a greater role in housing. This is not just a city-by-city issue, and it should not depend on what city you happen to live in terms of whether affordable housing is available.
And what do we mean when we say affordable?
Yeah. So I am when we say affordable housing, just to be clear what I mean and what I think, it is subsidized below market rate income-based housing. Affordable housing can mean different things, but we're talking about when there are subsidies involved and it's based on your income. In my view, our affordable housing subsidized housing program should be focused on our low-income residents, both people who we're bringing in off the street, who are our lowest income, into what we call supportive housing, and also our low-income working people, people who are working in, say, a Starbucks or in a restaurant setting where they're earning a living, but they're still low-income, particularly by San Francisco standards. Those are the people who are at greatest risk of displacement, the greatest risk of homelessness, who are hanging on by their fingernails, and our affordable housing program must focus on them. We do have a moderate middle-income subsidized housing program, which I support, but we will never subsidize our way out of our middle-class housing problem. It's too broad. The state has to do a few things. First of all, the state needs to provide significant support for supportive housing to help not just San Francisco but other cities get homeless people off the streets into not just putting them up in a room, but with the supportive services, mental health, drug addiction, job training, et cetera, that they need to be able to succeed. The state needs to provide more support for affordable housing overall. In San Francisco, we invest significantly in affordable housing. There are other cities that either don't have the resources or don't have the political will to do it. The state needs to help. The state also has a role to play in making sure that all cities are creating housing. It is not okay for some cities, and we know some of them in the Bay Area, that refuse to create any housing. It can't just be on San Francisco. It can't just be on a few cities. And the state is the only entity with the ability to have accountability and incentives for all cities to participate regionally and statewide in solving our housing crisis.
The California state legislature was highly criticized for not really tackling affordable housing this time around. We did a show about the more than 800 bills Jerry Brown signed. There were none that focused on affordable housing as far as we obviously couldn't read all of them. But if you go to Sacramento, what will you do for affordable housing? Are you planning to introduce a piece of legislation? No. Are you planning to team up with other politicians on this issue?
Yeah, and to be clear, there has been more housing activity in the legislature. For example, Assemblymember David Chu has authored legislation. I think one of them got vetoed. Mm. So there have been efforts to get more funding for affordable housing.
But they haven't passed.
They have not passed.
Right.
We've also had efforts, which I strongly support, to reform the Ellis Act, which have also not passed. So I think there have some of these efforts, when you only had certain cities that were experiencing the crisis, San Francisco and some other cities, it's hard to generate statewide support. As this housing affordability crisis spreads like a contagion around the state, you're going to see more and more support. So I'm cautiously optimistic. But for example, I authored legislation in San Francisco to significantly streamline the approval process for affordable housing. It should not take 2, 3, 4 years to approve an affordable housing project when you own the land and have the money, and yet that happens. So I authored legislation to streamline that process. I think that there is a good argument in Sacramento to similarly have a more streamlined process for affordable housing in California, not just in San Francisco. I will support efforts to increase state funding for affordable housing, particularly for supportive housing, but also for low-income housing for seniors. We have a growing issue of many, many low-income seniors in San Francisco and elsewhere who are in rent-controlled apartments. If they lose their unit, they're in deep trouble, and we have to make sure there's housing for them.
I am being bombarded with literature like so many people in the Bay Area, and I just got a flyer for measures U and P in San Francisco. We're going to describe these in a minute, but where do you stand on U and P?
And I want to make sure I don't confuse. There's so many. It shows how many there are when someone – I know each of the ballot measures, and there are too many letters that I – so I want to make sure I don't mess them up.
The people who are supporting it are calling it an affordable housing measure. People who oppose it – well, we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah. So the one that requires competitive bidding for affordable housing, which, again, I don't want to flip the two – that is P. P requires that when the city brings in nonprofit developers to do affordable housing, there has to be a competitive bidding process. I support that. I think our affordable housing process right now is not open and transparent enough. And so I think having an open bidding process makes sense.
And that's on P.
That's P. And P does still allow the city to take into account past track record. So if you have a shoddy developer, obviously you don't want to do business.
And I just want to read something on P from Street Sheet. This is the homeless newspaper in San Francisco. It says, measure P, under P, contracts for affordable housing projects on city-owned land must be put up to bid by three bidders, with the one deemed to have best value being awarded. And this article quotes Supervisor Aaron Peskin saying, P is a cynical, pernicious proposition aimed at building less affordable housing. If we get less than three bidders, we won't get affordable housing. Yeah. What's your response
to
that?
So that's I don't think that's accurate, and that's an opinion. I understand Supervisor Peskin opposes having an open, transparent bidding process for affordable housing, but I think it makes sense. Again, this is not my ballot measure, but on balance, I support it. Mm. For Prop U, I oppose Prop U. Prop U would increase the income eligibility level for affordable housing above low income up into middle income. And even though on the one hand, we all want to do everything we can to create more middle income housing, I don't want to reduce the amount of housing available to low income people who are struggling the most, are at greatest risk of homelessness, et cetera. And when we talk about low income, just to be clear, because in terms of the definition of low income, in San Francisco, low income is making up to about $38,000, or $40,000 a year for a single person, up to about $55,000 or $60,000 for a family of four. So that these are working people, working class people who are just not making a lot of money. And they are, you know, getting pushed out further and further away from the city, and we have to do more. So that's why I don't support that particular ballot measure.
Okay, so you support P and not U.
Correct.
Okay. Supervisor Scott Wiener supports Prop P, Measure P, but not Measure U. Today we are joined by Supervisor Scott Wiener, who is vying to take Senator Mark Leno's seat. Mark Leno's being termed out, representing San Francisco and San Mateo counties. He is running against Supervisor Jane Kim. She'll be on the show in a couple of weeks. Whoever wins this important seat could be in Sacramento for as many as 12 years, and they will represent 1 million people. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. This is turning out to be a very expensive race. Supervisor Wiener has raised over $2 million so far, and we will follow the money in just a couple minutes. But let's go to a couple calls. Let's hear from Darren in San Francisco. Hi, Darren. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you. Like much of the country, San Francisco's Black and Latino communities have frequently been victimized by police violence. Mario Woods, Emil Carveres, Luis Gongora, Jessica Williams, these are just some of the most recent people who were killed by San Francisco police. We also learned last year that SFPD deputies routinely exchange racist and homophobic text messages and emails with each other. And an independent blue ribbon panel that includes former California Supreme Court Justice Cruz Reynoso determined that a toxic culture of racism and us-against-them attitudes has been feeling the scourge of police violence against San Francisco's Black and brown communities. Unfortunately, Supervisor Wiener has taken a staunch position against any real police reform. When a modest police reform package that was inspired by a template provided by the Obama administration came before the DCCC in 2015, he supported Josh Arce's amendment to gut it to prevent any real reform from taking place. Supervisor Wiener has also received a large amount in campaign contributions from the police and has benefited from a negative independent expenditure campaign that the police are funding against Jane Kim. San Franciscans need to realize that Scott Wiener is one of the biggest defenders of police racism and violence in San Francisco today and probably all of California.
Okay, Darren,
if you think Black Lives Matter, you need to vote for Jane Kim.
Darren.
Yeah, I didn't realize that this was going to be a political ad show for my opponent. That statement, which I don't know who drafted that is wildly inaccurate. I have been supporting police reform since long before I was on the Board of Supervisors. In 2003, for people who were around then, Proposition H was on the ballot that took control of the police commission away from the mayor, divided the appointments, made it independent, and allowed the Office of Citizen Complaints to file disciplinary charges directly with the police commission. It was opposed by the police. It passed something like 51-49, and I supported it. I have supported body cameras for police officers. I supported the ballot measure that's on the measure on the ballot for November that makes the Office of Citizen Complaints an independent agency that Malia Cohen sponsored. I supported that. Jane Kim tried to kill it. So I have over and over again supported police reform. That doesn't mean we demonize the police. The vast majority of police officers never even fire their gun their entire career. It's about making sure that we are working hard to modernize our use of force policies, reduce the number of officer-involved shootings, emphasize de-escalation, and rebuild trust between the police and the communities that they serve, particularly communities of color.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. And if you do call in, please ask Supervisor Wiener a question. You can even have a dialogue with him, but we'd rather not have, you know, like a 2-minute
political ad.
Well, something that sounds like a political ad without having a discussion. Yeah. On police, we also have another comment from Eric, who says that, Supervisor Wiener, your predecessor, Mark Leno, pushed a number of police reform measures, including a bill that would demand more police accountability. When this bill was brought to the board as a resolution, you voted against it. Is that true? And can you explain why?
Sure. And at the time, I explained my vote. I do believe that we should have greater transparency in terms of these investigations. And if you're talking about, for example, when there's an independent investigation that finds wrongdoing for some serious use of force, for example, there should be transparency around that. Absolutely. And I said that at the time, and I've repeatedly talked about that. We all agree that the line needs to be drawn somewhere. And the bill that was at issue drew it in one place. I thought it should be drawn in a different place. The bill would have allowed for complaints to be and investigations to be made public, even if an independent investigation exonerated the officer. And so I had a concern about that. But I do support increased transparency, and I've been very consistent and clear about that.
We also have a question. You have been endorsed by the San Francisco Police Officers Association and are the chief sponsor of bills to increase the number of police and create a neighborhood police unit. How will you address police reform and continue this work at the state level when you have close ties to the SFPD and specifically the San Francisco Police Officers Association?
Sure. I work with the police in San Francisco in our neighborhoods every day. We work to keep our communities safe. I'm at community meetings with them all the time. And it's important to have a good working relationship with law enforcement. I also, there are times when I disagree with our police. I mentioned a ballot measure from a few years back that the Police Officers Association vigorously opposed and I supported. I have cast some votes at the Board of Supervisors this year that have really angered the Police Officer Association. I went through a number of months where they were really upset with me. And that's okay. That is, when you're elected to office, you have to make votes based on what you think is best for the community as a whole. And if you can't disagree with your allies, if you can't work with people and have a good relationship but sometimes disagree with them, which I have with the Police Officers Association, then you have no business being in politics or being in elected office. I make up my own mind. I always have. And there are sometimes that I have friends and allies that are really pissed off at me. And again, yeah, you gotta, if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen.
Well, thank you for the question, Eric. Today we are speaking with Supervisor Scott Wiener, who is running to replace Mark Leno's Senate seat in Sacramento. And let's go next to Graham in Corte Madera. Hi, Graham. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm a teacher. I make the median salary in San Francisco. So half of the city is going to have the same problems I have. I got evicted. I got no help from Mr. Wiener. I ended up having to move out of the city. I don't have rent control anymore. My rent more than doubled. So you're saying that the solution is paying teachers more. Well, that's not realistic. Tell me a realistic solution when housing is going up 20 to 40% a year, and there's no way, even with a doubled salary, I would call realtors and they would laugh at me. What holistic housing solution for now? Not a lottery.
Thank you for calling in, Graham.
So first of all, I don't know who the gentleman is. He didn't say his name. So in terms
Graham.
Of saying his full name, in terms of knowing, saying I wasn't of any help. I've helped over the last 6 years that I've been in office many, many tenants facing eviction. And just a woman came up to me on the street the other day and said, you know what? A few years ago, you saved my housing. And my daughter and I are still in our house, in our apartment, because of you. And so we work very, very hard, and I work hard to try to keep people stable in their housing, and it is a very high priority for me. So I'm sorry that this gentleman lost his housing. I have been a strong supporter of reforming the Ellis Act. I have over and over again supported for measures to or voted for measures to strengthen rent control. I have also been a champion for increased investment in affordable housing. And making sure that we are providing that housing. And I have campaigned for ballot measures. I'm doing so again this year. I work in the budget every year to increase affordable housing funding. I've authored three pieces of legislation to allow for new rent-controlled in-law units. So I don't just talk about housing. I don't just pontificate about it. I actually do the hard work. In terms of the crisis that we're facing, we have to keep people stable in their housing. That is job number one. But we also, in the long run, have to fix the structural housing shortage that we have in San Francisco. San Francisco has grown by 200,000 people since 1980. We didn't just start growing when Twitter moved into mid-market. We've been growing since Dianne Feinstein was mayor of San Francisco. The Bay Area has grown by almost 2 million people since 1980. And we have not created enough housing at all income levels to keep up with that growth. And that's why the apartment I moved into in the Castro in 1997 that I rented for $1,050 a month would be a $3,500 apartment today. That is because we have not created enough housing, and we have to solve that problem aggressively.
Well, thank you for that phone call. We have a message from Chris who says, can you talk about why you pushed for corporate-friendly tax laws like the Twitter tax break? Can you talk about why you don't support more regulation for Airbnb or for the Google buses?
Yeah, well, it's really, and by the way, I had heard that before today there was a social media effort to try to get people to call in with all sorts of loaded questions against me, which is totally fine. It's democracy. It's First Amendment. We heard that, of course, in the first question, which was basically a political ad for my opponent. But on this in particular, let's talk about the mid-market tax zone or Twitter tax break or whatever you want to call it. My opponent, Supervisor Jane Kim, was the co-author of that measure. Jane Kim co-authored the Twitter tax measure.
We'll ask her about
I voted for it. I voted for it. I absolutely stand by that vote. Mid-market has, but just to be clear, you know, the people who like to go after me for that and conveniently forget that Jane Kim was one of the co-authors of it. Jane Kim also voted for the Airbnb law. She voted for the 8 Washington Project. She's voted for and supported in her own district luxury housing with no affordable housing and then raises money from those luxury developers. So, you know, we need to be clear about what this race is about.
But we will bring that up in a couple of weeks with Jane Kim.
But in terms of the mid-market tax zone, mid-market has it has been a challenge for San Francisco going back to the 1950s. And there were articles written in the 50s and 60s about what should we do about mid-market. And we now actually have seen a rebirth of mid-market. There's housing there. Businesses are thriving there. There is street life there, and not just during 9 to 5 on the evenings and the weekends. And bringing businesses into the mid-market area, not just businesses, also theater uses and nonprofits, it has really been a positive for the area. And it's also important to note that I think sometimes people think that no tech company is paying taxes in San Francisco. Most tech companies in San Francisco are not in the mid-market area. They don't have access to those tax incentives. Most of the tech jobs we created are not in the mid-market area. They're in other parts of the city. This is a small area that needed attention, and I think we've made some positive change in this area. through that measure. So that's one area where the two candidates in this race agreed. We both supported it, and I think it's had positive benefits. In terms of short-term rentals and Airbnb, I have supported strong regulation for short-term rentals. I am a big believer that for people who are taking units off the market and they're no longer housing units, they're becoming hotels, whether it's one unit or an entire apartment building, we need to crack down like the wrath of God on those abuses. And I have supported legislation to make it easier to enforce. I've supported increases in funding for enforcement. I hold a quarterly oversight hearing to bring in our Office of Short-Term Rentals to talk about enforcement, to have transparency in terms of what they're doing.
Are there more staffers in that department? Because last time we talked about it, so many people said it's understaffed. There's just not enough people to do the job.
Yeah, well, I think every time we staff it, there's more and more, because it obviously, you know, people have concerns and people make reports, which they should do. But I will also say that sometimes people want to go overboard in the regulation and kill off short-term rentals entirely. And my concern is I have a lot of residents in my district, and they're in other parts of the city too, who are not abusing anything, who live in their units, who didn't evict anyone, who have a spare bedroom. They do not want a permanent roommate. They want the flexibility to have the place to themselves sometimes, or to have family members visit. And they want to be able to rent out that spare bedroom. And sometimes they're older, or they're on fixed incomes. This is the only way that they can earn money. And the idea that we would prevent them from doing that, which is what some of these overly zealous measures would have done, I just don't buy that. I think we need to have good regulations, which we have adopted, and we need to enforce them aggressively.
All right. Well, thank you for that question. Supervisor Weiner, we're almost out of time, but I want to ask you about money, because our listeners, as you know, and I'm sure you are, people are really angry about money in politics. And your race is set to become one of the most expensive for this specific seat. You've raised over $2 million. And I know that you know Jane Kim has a press release going out there, Follow the Money, behind corporate candidate Scott Weiner. And according to Jane Kim's campaign, on April 11th, Chevron made a major corporation to an independent expenditure group known as Californians for Jobs and a Strong Economy. The $300,000 donation from Chevron accounts for nearly half of what this group raised. Can you talk about this? Because a lot of people are wondering whether Chevron is giving money to Scott Weiner.
Yeah, and I would actually, it's unfortunate that that you brought that up, because
I'm getting a lot of emails about it.
Yeah, there's actually no factual basis to that whatsoever. I am the only candidate in this race with an environmental record. I'm the only candidate in this race with a record on clean energy. I'm endorsed by the California League of Conservation Voters. Chevron is not supporting me. I have never taken a penny of oil money. That is on my list, along with tobacco and a few others, that of a no-fly zone, where I do not take oil or any fossil fuel money. And there was no Chevron money in the outside expenditure that was done on my behalf in the primary. That was done, by the way, what you didn't mention, and what Jane Kim doesn't mention, that expenditure was by Equality California, the largest LGBT civil rights organization in California, with a long track record of supporting the LGBT community. And they're going to the mat for me in my campaign because they don't want to have zero LGBT representation out of Sacramento. There was not a penny of Chevron money in there. That is a bald-faced lie by Jane Kim and her campaign that they keep telling. What she also didn't say in that release is that Jane Kim was a beneficiary, and this is undisputed, of a $40,000 expenditure by PG&E in the primary. Jane Kim is the PG&E candidate in this race because they know she will never lift a finger for clean energy. And right now, what this doesn't mention is that Jane Kim is the beneficiary of over $100,000 in outside spending by the soda industry, which is funding mailers that feature Jane Kim. Jane Kim is the soda industry candidate in this race. She opposes the soda tax, which I co-authored. She is not supporting children's health. And guess what? Guess who is the consultant for PG&E and for the soda industry? Jane Kim's consultant. Jane Kim has also supported Academy of Art University and tried to kill my legislation to stop Academy of Art from cannibalizing rent-controlled housing stock. Jane Kim is the corporate candidate in this race, and I know that some of her partisans don't want to hear that, but when you follow the money that she is benefiting from PG&E, from Academy of Art, from the soda industry, and huge contributions from luxury condo developers doing business in her district. Jane Kim has a higher percentage of developer and real estate money than I do. She's raised almost $1.5 million. You didn't mention that.
Well, she's going to be on in 2 weeks, and we're going to talk about all of this with
her. I understand. But she has raised significant money, and she is raising it mostly from outside of San Francisco. I have almost 3,000 people have given to my campaign, and a majority of them have given $250 or less, and almost 80% of them are San Francisco residents. So I am proud of our grassroots fundraising effort to support our work around housing and transit and schools and healthcare and other great needs.
Well, we wanted to get you on the record about this because it is out there. People are asking about it.
Right, because Jane Kim's campaign continues to put out this completely false and slanderous information.
Well, we will ask her about that in 2 weeks. Supervisor Scott Wiener is running against Jane Kim to fill California State Senator Mark Leno's seat representing San Francisco and San Mateo counties. And whoever wins in November could hold this important seat in Sacramento for as many as 12 years and represent 1 million people. Supervisor Wiener, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. We're going to take a quick break, and then after the break, we will talk about San Francisco Public Press's new guide looking at San Francisco measures. Stay with us.
You're listening to a special Your Call Election Edition. If you're a Bay Area voter, as you know, you've got a record number of initiatives and candidates to vote on this November, and you know how important it is to be informed. So as KLW reports on the election, we're asking for your help. Tell us what we should keep an eye on and why. Go to KLW.org and click the box that says Help Us Report on the 2016 elections. It's easy, and it will make a difference for all of us here in the Bay Area.
This is Your Call Special Election Edition. I'm Rose Aguilar, and now we are going to talk about a new guide from San Francisco Public Press, the independent media outlet. They've put together a great guide which looks at campaign spending, endorsements, races, and measures. And we're joined by Noah Arroyo, assistant editor at Public Press. He writes about housing, government, business, and crime. Hi, Noah. Thanks for coming in.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So, thank you for putting this guide together. 25 measures.
Yeah.
It's very overwhelming. We're trying to do as much as we can.
Right.
But when you all sat down to do this, how did you go about it to make it as easily accessible to citizens as possible?
Well, we had to do our due diligence. We had to first off dive into the legal text for all of the ballot measures. So that was a lot of diving, a lot of reading legalese. Incredibly dry. So it's what you and I do. It's what reporters do. Aside from that, we did original reporting on plenty of the measures. We looked at campaign finance spending. We looked at other people's work. We vetted that. So ultimately, our approach was to organize the measures into categories, which I think is really what this product is all about, if I could call it that. There are 25 measures on the ballot. And actually, do you mind if I tell you why I got into this personally?
Please, please.
Okay. Because there are plenty of reasons why the public press would want to do something like this. You know, it aligns with our mission statement. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan news outlet, and we specialize in special reports that are seasonal and in print. So this is sort of supplemental to that material. It makes sense for us. Me, the first 6 months of this year, I was really disappointed with the media coverage on the upcoming election, especially the local election. It was a constant and loud refrain that, oh my God, there are 25 measures on the ballot, and how can we digest all this? And this is, you know, this is a result of a malfunction at local government. You know, if our legislators could do their jobs, then we wouldn't have 25 measures. And okay, that's fine. And if that's true, fine. But that doesn't energize voters. That doesn't educate voters. My other problem was that a lot of people responded to that sort of narrative by saying, well, just, you know, voters just look to see what organizations you believe in, look to see what they're endorsing. And once again, this, you know, this stifles a desire to learn.
So true.
And so what we decided to do was to give the information to voters. I realize that there are 25 measures. I don't expect people to learn details about them all. And so what we've done is to organize them into categories so that if you care about housing and development issues, then there are 5 measures that you should be looking at. You can go to our page, sfpublicpress.org. High up on the page, you're going to see a link. Go in there. They're sorted by categories. Click on one. If you care about policing, go there. There are 2 measures that we say predominantly fall into that category, and so on and so on. And last thing, just a final plug about this project. This is an organic document as far as we're concerned. We want this thing to grow over time and become better and better. And if that means that we need to field, you know, copious phone calls or emails, please tweet me. My Twitter handle is pretty easy to find. Just look for my name, my byline on the project page. But we want to know what you think. What you like, what you don't like, and if you have a counter-narrative, you know, for our narrative, then perhaps we need to revisit it. Maybe we need to supplement ours. So please reach out.
I love that you categorize things: funding infrastructure, raising taxes, policing, mm-hmm. government oversight, balance of power, elections. There is a lot that we're voting on, and I'm just starting to now get tons of flyers
right.
in the mail.
Right.
What really struck you about the amount of money that is being spent on these local measures?
Well, I mean, it's being spent in the places that you would imagine. And I looked, I think the most recent time was maybe a week or two ago. I looked at SF Ethics. If you go to their website, everybody, then you can check out campaign finance spending. Big Soda is behind the anti-Prop V campaign. They're sending out mailers talking about how the soda tax or the sweetened beverage tax is actually a grocery tax. And the problem with pushing back on this narrative is that it's not entirely technically false. It really all depends on how the tax gets implemented in San Francisco if it gets passed. And so it's a strong argument in that way. However, it's not the whole story. This would be a tax on distributors. And so it would be the distributor's choice whether or not to pass the tax on to markets. And therefore, it would be market's choice whether or not to pass the tax on to customers. So there are a lot of points in this workflow, and they could all move one way or the other. And so Big Soda is trying to, you know, it's trying to control the narrative, and it's doing it with a lot of money.
Mm, yeah, I've already received a lot of flyers about this one. If you have any questions or comments about the measures specifically that we'll be voting on in San Francisco, we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. This is a great guide that you can find at sfpublicpress.org. They took a look at measures A to X and then RR, which is the $3.5 billion bond for BART. We did a show about that a couple weeks ago. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. And there are different subjects: housing, development, city hall spending. Let me ask you this. Which ones would you say are really important that aren't getting that much attention?
Oh, okay. This one is our – I've grappled with this question because I figured you might ask me. And I don't have a clean answer.
I see a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm also slightly hesitant to point voters in one or another direction just because I don't want to emulate what political groups do. Now, that said, the ones that I personally find most interesting, and I'm not speaking for Public Press, I'm speaking for me, Prop O, which would expedite office construction in the city southeast. These are the Bayview, Hunter Point, and Candlestick neighborhoods. This has a lot of interesting details to it, and I suggest that everybody dive into the page. I think the best takeaway would be something like Lennar, the developer there, is looking to get an exemption from a law that's existed for many, many years that has limited office construction citywide. There's no reason to think that this won't create a precedent for future projects. However, that's merely speculation. Right now, they're slated to produce 3.15 million square feet of office space. The land could hold up to 5.15 million square feet of office space, but they'd have to negotiate for that difference. However, only 800,000 square feet of that space right now is prioritized development. Basically, this means that if nothing changes, then after they build out that 800,000 square feet, they're going to have to get in line with everybody else for the city's annual limitation program on office development. That's something they obviously don't want to do. That means a loss of money for them.
And you have a follow the money section on all of mm-hmm. this. Mm-hmm. One committee is spending money in support of Prop O, mm-hmm. Jobs, Housing, and Parks Now for Candlestick Point and Hunters Point Shipyard. That's a long one. Mm-hmm. As of late, that committee has raised $350,000 mm-hmm. entirely from one contributor. Mm-hmm. That is Five Point Holdings. Mm-hmm. This is the company managing the project, and it's owned by Lennar.
You betcha.
All right. Well, there you go. So the facts, follow the money, really good information over at publicpress.org. And if you have any questions, well, actually, we're almost out of time. These shows go by right. so quickly. Let's talk. We're starting to get a lot of mailers on props U and P.
Okay.
The people who oppose these say it's PU. It's a good way to go on the ballot box to not vote. But talk a little bit about props P and U, because these are starting to get attention now. We just heard from Supervisor Weiner on Prop P and U. He said he supports – I want to get this right. I'll have to get the information. I don't want to get that wrong. But let's talk about Prop P.
Prop P. So this would – Prop P?
Yes, he supports Prop P.
Prop P would be – let's see. That would
– competitive bidding for affordable housing.
It would
housing.
Require that an affordable housing project through the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development, that such a project would receive three bids before it can move forward. Right now, most of the projects receive three bids per the city's report on this. 40% don't, or about 40%. And of those, if you take Olson Lee's word for it, he's the director of the Office of Housing. These projects that don't get at least three bids are complicated projects. Therefore, not a lot of developers would want to go after them. Or they're projects that would house, you could say, vulnerable populations, such as transgender youths. So it's speculative, but it might be that Prop P is sort of a NIMBYist proposition. However, that's very difficult to prove. I'm not sure how interested I am in Prop P. I can tell you I'm very interested in Prop U, personally.
Okay.
Prop U would increase the income threshold for people who wanted to get into some affordable housing. To put this in perspective, there are about 39,000 units of affordable housing – or not affordable, rather – housing that is priced below the market rate citywide. This is as of the end of December last year. Now, only about 2,000 of those units fall into the program that would be affected by this proposition. And of those, about 40% of those units are for are right now going to low-income people, people making up to about 60% of the region's median income. I realize that this is a lot of details, which is why you kind of need to dive in.
Yeah.
But Prop U would raise the income threshold. So for this slate of affordable housing, which is not big, but it is meaningful, people making up to about $75,000 a year as individuals could get into affordable housing. This opens up the pool for that, and that's a big deal because there's high demand mm-hmm. for affordable housing right now. We're talking 19 units come online, 2,000 people apply.
And in the follow the money section, one committee is so far spending money to support Prop U. California Association of Realtors issues mobilization pack, and the San Francisco Association of Realtors. Mm. Two committees are spending money to oppose the measure, stop the developer giveaway, no on P and U. Mm. And again, you can find all of this information at SF Public Press. We have a lot of reading still to do, and we have a couple more, about a month before the election, so we've
right.
got four more shows focusing on all of these important issues. Noah Arroyo is assistant editor at Public Press, and you can find the guide, excellent guide.
Thanks
Thank you
very
to
much.
You and everybody at Public Press, sfpublicpress.org.
Thank
Thanks
you.
For coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for joining us for this special election edition of Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar.